Well, with Dr. Joe Dispenza, his book, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself. Joe, you have in part three techniques for people to start breaking the habit, but you really think they need to get through parts one and two in order to get that far, don't they?
Yeah, you know, one of the things about change is that you got to understand how change works. You got to understand a little bit about how the brain and the body works, and got to understand different states of mind. So the first two parts of the book really are just, you know, simple science to help people understand who they are and what it is to change and why change is so hard, so that when we get to the third part of the book, which is the how-to, they know exactly what they're doing and why, and nothing's left to conjecture or dogma or speculation. They know what they're doing, and then when they have their intention behind it, it seems to work a lot better.
What is, in your opinion, the most important thing that people should be aware of if they want to change? Or even why change?
Well, I think most of us memorize certain emotions that become part of our identity. You know, when we react to something in our life, some condition in our life, as I said, the end product of an experience is an emotion. What most people don't know is that when they react to something in their life, there's a refractory period of chemicals that are created from that experience. And if you don't know how to control that emotional reaction, and you allow that refractory period to last for hours or even days, that's called a mood. So you see someone and you say to them, "What's wrong?" And they say, "Well, I'm in a mood." And you say, "Well, why are you in a mood?" And they say, "Well, this thing happened to me 5 days ago." And what that really means is the same emotion chemicals are running through their body that are keeping them connected to a past experience. Now, if you keep that refractory period going on for weeks or even months, that's called a temperament. So you say, "Why is that guy so angry? Oh, why does he have such an angry temperament?" And so you ask him, "Why are you so angry?" And he says, "Well, this thing happened to me 10 months ago." And what he's really saying is, "This thing happened to me 10 months ago, and I'm memorizing my emotional reaction." Now, if we keep that same refractory period going on for years on end, that's called a personality trait. So we tend to develop our personality based on past experiences that emotionally brand us. So in order to change our personality, we have to look at the emotions that we've memorized that's become part of our identity. And so to shorten refractory period of our emotional reactions is called emotional intelligence. And people who tend to hold on to experiences then tend to live by those emotions, which keep them anchored in the past. And we can't go to a new future. We can't create a new life or a new future holding on to the emotions of the past. We have to begin to layer by layer begin to unmemorize those emotional states. And that's what the part three of the book is about. What emotion have you memorized that's become part of your identity? That's actually not who you are. It's just your memory of the past. And so when you teach people how to change those emotional states, you liberate some energy. And, of course, they see a new landscape that they never saw before because they're not perceiving reality through the filter of that emotion. They're not looking at realities of the past.
Joe, how do people know that they need to change? You know, a lot of people don't know themselves. So how do they know they should change?
Well, one of the feedback mechanisms that we know we need to change is our life. You know, you look in the mirror and you see your face, and that reflection tells you who you are as an identity. Our life is a reflection of our mind or our ego, and the way we begin to see that it's time to change is we start getting feedback in the form of situations in our life that are showing us that the things that we're doing repeatedly aren't producing a result that we want, or the feedback from our body. In other words, we start to get sick or we don't feel as well, and we begin to notice that we're no longer feeling like ourselves any longer. So the feedback mechanism that we get through our life or our environment, through our body, is usually a strong enough signal for people to begin to say, "I don't look good," or "I don't feel good," or, you know, "Gosh, this thing keeps showing up in my life, and I need to begin to make changes." So feedback is the mechanism that lets us know.
That's pretty dramatic. Now, when you were doing all of this, did you come across any pitfalls in the research? Anything that you found that, you know, this is going to be a tough one to work on?
Well, I think that change is tough, period, George. I think that to begin to make sustained changes in our life, given the fact that most of us are busy and we have families and we have jobs and, you know, we're multitasking, change isn't as easy as, you know, I just want to eat vanilla ice cream instead of chocolate ice cream. That's not really changing your mind. There has to be an effect that begins to happen in the body. And one of the things that I noticed in studying change is that many people, they have a desire or a dream to change something about themselves, but they actually don't think it's possible on any level or on a subconscious level. So one of the things we've also noticed is that when you give people information on how change occurs neurologically and biologically, and you give them the resources on how to do it, they'll make a stronger effort. And the hardest part of all of this, the hardest part without a doubt in the change game, is making the time to do it. Making time for ourselves to begin to, you know, remove ourselves from our predictable lives and take time for ourselves to begin to ask some important questions like, what is a greater expression of myself? What's a greater way to be? What do I have to change about myself in order to change? Who in history do I admire? Do I want to be like? And what do I want to be in my future? And these type of open-ended questions, these type of frontal lobe questions, I call them, are the questions that begin to change the mind. Now, making time for ourselves to begin to separate ourselves from our life and to begin to think and feel differently begins to produce amazing results. Now, the Newtonian model of reality is about cause and effect. In other words, the external environment, something outside of us, changes how we feel inside of us. And when we notice right. that we feel altered inside of us, we pay attention to whoever or whatever caused that.
Events occur, right?
Right. And that cause and effect is really us living at the victims to the environment. Now, you know, the true aspect of change it has nothing to do with the environment changing how we think and feel. The true aspect of change is coming out of our resting state and changing how we think and feel independent of the environment. And when we change how we think and feel independent of the environment and we can maintain that modified state of mind and body, now we're no longer living at cause and effect, but now we are in fact causing an effect. This is where people begin to feel empowered. So you and I have been hypnotized and conditioned into believing that we need a reason for joy, that we need a reason for gratitude. We need a reason to feel good. That's that Newtonian model of cause and effect. The quantum model says this. Your subjective mind, how you think and feel, produces measurable effects. But I think that most people, you know, the model is our personality creates our personal reality. It's that simple. And our personality is made up of how we think, how we act, and how we feel. So the present personality who's listening on the radio show today has created their present personal reality called their life, which means then if you wanted to create a new personal reality, a new life, you would have to change on some fundamental level the thoughts you think, the behaviors that you demonstrate, and the emotions that you live by. So if we need a reason for gratitude, we need a reason for joy, then we're at effect. We're always waiting for something to happen. The quantum model says, let's begin to move into an elevated state. Let's begin to condition the body into believing that future event is happening to us now. And when we make time for ourselves to practice this, then we're no longer living life as materialists any longer, using our senses to define reality. We're actually changing inside of us in mind and body and then looking for the effects outside of us. And when people begin to understand that that's possible, change becomes more inspiring.
Is meditation the same as self-hypnosis?
That's a great question, and my answer is yes. My answer is absolutely yes, because, you know, whether you're doing a meditation or you're doing self-hypnosis, brainwave patterns tend to be exactly the same, and when you get beyond that analytical mind, that's when you can begin to imprint information or encode information into the subconscious. So, our 5% of our mind is our conscious mind, and 95% is our subconscious. And what separates those two is the analytical mind. And And again, then when we get beyond that analytical mind, we are entering into that domain. So, yes, they're very similar.
Joe, I know some people in St. Louis that are nice people, but some of them just don't have that personality. You know, they chase people away. They go into a room and, you know, rather than people feeling electrified, they run away. They can't stand it. What are they doing wrong, and how do people like that change their life?
Well, this is a long conversation.
That's a long show.
But let's get back to the hormones of stress. Listen, when you and I, well, first of all, stress is when your body's knocked out of homeostasis. Stress is when your body's knocked out of balance. The stress response is what your body innately does to return back to order, to return back to balance. Now, every single organism in nature is designed for short-term stress. A gazelle is, you know, grazing in the Serengeti. The lion sees the gazelle. As soon as the lion begins to notice one gazelle walking out of pattern in the herd, she senses weakness, and she turns on a primitive nervous system called her fight-or-flight nervous system. And when she turns on that primitive nervous system, she's saying, this is lunch for my cubs. And she begins to mobilize enormous amounts of energy so that she can begin to survive in her environment. Now, when the gazelle sees the lion, she turns on her fight-or-flight nervous system or her sympathetic nervous system, and she's saying, I have to get away from this predator. Now, if the gazelle outruns the lion, 15 minutes later, it goes back to grazing. In other words, the stress is over. Human beings, well,
they fester. No.
We turn on the stress response. We can turn on that stress response just by thought alone. We can begin to speculate some possibility. We can begin to think of some worst-case scenario. We can begin to try to predict the future based on the past. And the privilege of being a human being, because of the size of the frontal lobe, is that we can make thought more real than anything else. And as we begin to attend to those thoughts, we begin to knock our body out of balance just by thought alone. And when we keep knocking the body out of balance, when we turn on the stress response and we can't turn it off, now we're headed for disease. And those emotions of the chemicals of stress create the emotions of anger and aggression and hatred and frustration and fear and anxiety and insecurity and depression and pain and suffering and hopelessness and powerlessness. Those states we've considered normal states of human consciousness, and they're actually what I call altered states of consciousness. The normal states of human consciousness is what mystics and poets have been talking about for generations, where we feel elevated and we feel lifted and we feel clear and our mind and body is healthy. So those hormones of stress, when we mobilize all that energy, we become junkies to that rush of energy. It's like a triple cappuccino. And so we look for the conditions in our life to reaffirm that rush so that we can remember who we think we are. And so we become enslaved to those emotions of stress, and then those emotions of stress begin to cause us to become very selfish, very self-involved, very self-centered, very self-indulgent, very self-serving, because when those hormones of stress are running, it's all about the body, the environment, and time. We become obsessed with our bodies, our body parts. We become obsessed with things we should own, things we should have, things mm-hmm. in our environment, and we become obsessed about time. And when we move into that state, we're trying to define reality by our senses. We're trying to control our reality by living as materialists. And that, of course, is when we begin to push out or hold on, or we try to manipulate or be cunning, and, you know, greed and deception, dishonesty. It's all created from those emotions of stress, and we become enslaved to it.
Chapter 7 of your book is called The Gap. What is that?
Well, I think we reach a point in our life, you know, by the time we're 35 or 45 years old, right in that range, where we've experienced most of what life has to offer. We've had relationships, we understand sexuality, we've been successful, we've failed, we've felt most of the emotions that come along with being a human. And when we reach this point where where you can predict the feeling of how everything is going to happen in our life, all of a sudden we realize that there isn't much that life has to offer. And, you know, we grow up as children and we have certain experiences that knock us out of balance and we begin to feel certain ways. But because we can put all of our attention on the external environment, we can, you know, begin to identify or create an identity by identifying with things in our outer world, we can distract ourselves from those feelings that we have as children. So we begin to create this gap. And if you take one hand and you place it about that eye level and the other hand at your waist level, that gap, the upper hand represents how we appear to the world, the identity or the image we project to the external world. That's the facade. And how we really feel inside is those emotions that we've been running away from, that emptiness or that insecurity. Now, for the first several years of our life, the first 35 years of our life, we can, you know, get a job or go to school or learn new things or get married and get divorced or have kids and do all these things, buy cars, buy homes to distract us from that feeling. Well, right around 35 or 45, all of a sudden, nothing's making that feeling go away
any
longer.
No, not at all. You're not happy with possessions.
That's right. You become possessed by your possessions, and you begin to realize that there's got to be something more to life. And this is when the soul begins to wake up and nudge us and start to say, pay attention to this feeling, because if you don't look at this feeling, you're never going to evolve in your life. Now, this is the midlife crisis, and some people actually look down at that emotion and they say, look, I never loved you. I don't even know what love is. I don't want to go out with those people any longer. I don't want to fake that I'm happy. What is God? What is life? What happens after we die? They start asking some really important questions. And everybody in their life thinks that they're losing their mind. And so they try to help them return back up to that top hand again, that the image or the ideal for the world instead of the ideal for themselves. And so they go to the doctor and they get Prozac, and all of a sudden the feeling goes away, and they return back to the same identity. Other people, this is a midlife crisis, they try to create a new identity by, you know, getting new, you know, creating new things in their environment to create a new identity. They buy the sports car, they buy the boat, they get the facelift, they join a new social club to meet new people, they go on vacation to a new place, they buy new things. It's all about the environment to try to make this feeling go away. And then when the novelty of that those things wear off, that feeling comes back. And this is where it gets pretty intense, because the whole next level has to do with addiction. This is where people begin to drink more, they begin to shop more, they begin to use drugs, or they gamble, or they overeat, or they undereat, or they video game, or they do pornography, or whatever it is.
Whatever it is, yeah.
Try to make that feeling go away. And there's nothing, the beauty behind this is that human beings innately want to evolve. They want to change, but they think that change has to happen outside of them. Now, when they gamble or when they shop or when they use a drug, the rush of chemistry that's created in the brain and body is such an intense chemical rush that the receptor sites on the outside of the cells begin to become desensitized. And what happens is the next time they shop, the next time they gamble, the next time they use a drug, they need a little bit more. This then begins to hijack the pleasure centers to a higher level. So now they need more drugs to get the same high or shop more. If they spend $5,000, now they need to spend $10,000 because $5,000 doesn't produce the same high. And as they begin to invest all of their energy into the external environment to begin to try to make that feeling inside of them go away immediately, the moment they notice that feeling going away inside of them, they pay attention to whoever or whatever caused it.
Well, that's a great point. Hold on, Joe. Let's talk more about that. We're also going to talk about consciousness when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Dr. Joe Dispenza as we talk about his work, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself. More questions, though, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Joe, before we get into some more questions about this high, I think that was fascinating. Tell me about where we can get your book, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself. And I also understand you also have some monthly teleclasses.
Yeah, the book is on Amazon right now, so you can order it off of Amazon. You can go to our website and order it off our website, drjoedispenza.com. And, And the teleclass that we've done is I do a lot of workshops around the world and in different parts of the country, and people want to stay connected to the work or they want to ask questions. And we probably get over 100 emails a day, believe it or not, on our website. And so instead of us having to try to answer all of these, we've created a teleclass that's the last Thursday of every month. It's 12 in the afternoon Pacific time. And it's a one hour and 50 minute class. I do about 20 to 30 minutes where we develop a concept, and then we just open the lines up for questions, and I can really take an idea and take it through so people could understand the outcome. So teleclass has become a really popular service on our website because it's a good interactive process.
Sure is, and convenient too, isn't it? Really is. All right, you were talking about the high and and how people try to, you know, get more and more. Is that like a serial killer? He gets high when he kills, so he has to keep killing, right?
Absolutely. And you could talk about a serial killer, or you could talk about a victim who stirs up his or her emotional states in order to produce some change in their internal chemistry. And it's an unfortunate thing, but whether you talk about overeating or undereating or gambling or murdering or biting your fingernails, whatever it is, it's all an attempt to try to make that feeling that we've memorized go away. Now, until we look at that feeling and we begin to observe how we think when we feel that way, when we begin to pay attention to the habits or how we act when we're trying to make that feeling go away, until we begin to notice that feeling and begin to say, look, the more I try to make this feeling go away by something outside of me, the more I'm going to create a bigger gap. Now, as we begin to unmemorize those emotions and we begin to close the gap between how we appear and who we are, that's called transparency. And layer by layer, when we begin to make those changes inside of us, every time we unmemorize an emotion, we liberate energy out of the body. Now, if a person is living by certain emotions that they can't change, then their body is literally living in the past. Now, the body is the unconscious mind, George, and it does not know the difference between an experience in your life that produces an emotion and an emotion that you fabricate by thought alone. So a person who's living in a cycle of emotion that creates thoughts, that creates emotions, that creates thoughts, this loop, the body, as the unconscious mind, is literally living in the past, and it's believing that it's in the same circumstances 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it's that type of chemical redundancy that begins to push the genetic buttons that begin to create disease. So as the person begins to unmemorize those emotions, they begin to liberate energy out of the body, and the body is free from the chains of those emotions. And that liberation of energy is called joy, and that joy doesn't come from outside of them. It actually comes from inside of them, and they begin to make those changes. Not from trying to make the feeling go away by something or some substance or some action, but because they've overcome some aspect of themselves and they begin to feel liberated. And that's what I call the natural state of being.
What do you see as the difference between consciousness and subconscious?
Well, I will say the difference between conscious mind and subconscious mind. Conscious mind is the part of us that we use to navigate pretty much our actions in our waking day. Now, if we think about it, we've been saying throughout the course of the show tonight that 95% of who we are by the time we're 35 years old is a set of subconscious or unconscious behaviors, emotional reactions, and thoughts and attitudes that become part of our identity. So if you understand that 95% of us by the time we're 35, are living in subconscious states, and the body's the unconscious mind, then for the most part, most of the time, people are literally unconscious because they're running a series of programs, just like computer programs. So only when we truly become conscious, I mean really conscious, is being really present and being aware in that moment. And consciousness is awareness. Awareness is paying attention, and paying attention is noticing, and only when we wake up and become truly conscious are we able to begin to make measurable changes in our lives.
Well, that's a good point, too. So if people want to start changing, What do you recommend? What are the first things they start to do? Do they have to identify what that is, what they want to fix?
Absolutely. I mean, anytime we want to change anything, we got to first look at what is it that we want to change. And so, you know, most people think that change happens outside of them. You know, like if we get rid of this person or if we kick the cat out of the house, or it has something to do with changing, you know, our external conditions. And really, the first aspect of change is really noticing how you think. Begin to become conscious of those emotions that bring you to a lower denominator every day, and become aware of your habits and behaviors that keep producing the same experiences, that keep reaffirming the same emotions. And this process, not a lot of people like to light a match in a dark place, but the process of change really is becoming conscious of those unconscious states. So, you know, people say, well, where do I start? And I say, look, it's very simple. We're so distracted by our external environment that we wake up every day and do the same things as we started the show with, and we begin to reproduce the same levels of mind that begin to become automatic programs. Sit down in the morning and ask yourself this question. What is the greatest ideal or the expression of myself that I want to be today? And you begin to say, let me remind myself the thoughts that keep me returning back to the old self. Let me begin to review and begin to become aware of my unconscious habits so that I'm so aware of them and so conscious that they would never slip by me unnoticed today. And what are the emotions that keep me returning back to the same self that really are just a reflection of my past? And as we begin to remind ourselves who we no longer want to be and we become conscious of those unconscious states, we're more prone to, in our waking day, not slip back to the old self sitting on the couch who just said earlier that they wanted to get in shape. And then if you said, what are the thoughts that I do want to put my energy behind? What are the behaviors I do want to demonstrate? And what are the emotions, what elevated emotions do I want to live by today? And if you said, I'm not going to get up from this meditation until I am this person, we would say then that the moment you began to think differently, you would begin to make your brain work in new sequences and new patterns and new combinations. And when you begin to speculate possibilities and begin to forecast new outcomes, and your brain begins to work differently, you're changing your mind. Now, when you do that repeatedly and you remind yourself who you want to be every day, you begin to install the neurological circuitry in your brain to look like the experience has already happened. In other words, as you begin to think differently and as you begin to plan new behaviors, your brain does not know the difference between the actual experience in your life that produces those circuits, or what you fabricate by thought alone, which means we can change our brain just by thinking differently. Now, if we're so involved in that thought process that the thought in our mind literally becomes an experience, the end product of an experience is called an emotion. As we're sitting there in the comfort of our own home and we're beginning to think about a new way of being and reminding ourselves who we do want to be, if the thought becomes the experience, thoughts are the language of the brain, but feelings are the language of the body. And the moment the body begins to get a chemical signal because you begin to embrace that event, your body begins to epigenetically change and you move into a new state of being. Now, if you said, I'm going to memorize this state so that nothing, no person, no thing, no experience is going to remove me from this the remainder of my day, we could say that that new state of being is a new personality. And a new personality then, of course, creates a new personal reality.
Joe, what are epigenetics?
Well, biology used to say that, you know, genes were the cause of disease. And now we know that it's a scientific fact that, you know, less than 5% of the people on the planet are born with a genetic condition. The other 95% of the conditions are created from lifestyle, from choices. And genes then are actually what make proteins. And we actually have a gene that can begin to regulate in 2,000 different variations. The same gene can begin to function in 2,000 different variations. And when the environment or the The chemistry outside of the cell signals the gene in a different way. The gene begins to respond differently, and that's epigenetics.
Breaking the habit of being yourself, how to lose your mind, create a new one. How long does it all take, Joe? What's the process?
Well, you know, the way we've set it up in the book is we've designed a four-week process for people. And we've asked
That's not bad.
No, it's not bad at all, because we've asked them to actually practice one particular skill for 1 week. And then after you get that first skill down, then practice the skill of the first week and add the second week. And then after you've gotten those down, add the third week, and then from there, add the fourth week. Now, here's what we know. We've been teaching these workshops pretty much around the world for the last 3 years, and we've witnessed some pretty amazing changes in people's lives. And as I said, the hardest part of all of this is making the time to do it. If you took 40 minutes out of your day and you began to follow a very specific program and you stuck with it for a period of time, you would begin to change your mind and body. And when you change your mind and body, you're moving into a new state of being. So it takes a little bit of effort. And just like any skill, in the beginning, you have to restrain certain impulsive behaviors. You got to begin to focus a little bit better. You got to stay consistent with it. But if you do, we know, in fact, that it works.
The work through all this, when people are trying to change, is it okay to go to a friend and say, what would you change about me if you could do that?
We always joke around about this in our workshops, because men tend to be the ones that always say, you know, I think I'm doing okay. And their wife is standing next to them
shaking their heads,
no,
yeah.
Saying, no, he really isn't. And so if people have difficulties, you know, they're so busy, you know, they're so absorbed in being who they think is okay, and they can't be objective enough to see themselves from another point of view. Of course, it's always a good idea to get someone who loves you enough to tell you the truth, to say, man, wow, you really complain a lot, or man, you really make excuses for yourself.
Well, sometimes the outsider sees it better than the individual.
Yeah, the observer from the outside, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things I definitely would do. I'd go to a close person in your life and
say,
that's
a good place to start.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, if there's something about me you'd like to change, what? And then work on it.
Yeah.
And see what happens. What kind of results after 4 or 5 weeks do people see?
Well, we've seen, you know, just amazing things happen over the course of 4 weeks or even less. You know, as I've been saying all along, the process of change, or the biological model, requires unlearning and relearning. It requires breaking the habit of the old self and then reinventing a new self. It requires what we call in neuroscience pruning synaptic connections, which means you no longer fire and you no longer wire the same circuits, and you biologically change your circuitry, and then to sprout and fire and wire new connections and new circuits. It requires unmemorizing emotions that exist in your body and then reconditioning your body to a new mind and to a new emotion. It requires moving from your past memories into some future memories. And so everybody says, you know, to change a habit, it takes 21 days. That actually, there's no real science to prove that. There's a lot of variables that allow us to change. I mean, it has to do with you know, your attention span, how long in the process you do it, if you do it every single day, how often you do it. There's a lot of variables that create change. But what we've seen with people doing our meditations is that we've seen people diagnosed with MS, with lupus, with thyroid conditions like Hashimoto's syndrome. We've seen people with cancers, diabetes, chronic pain, all kinds of physical ailments literally move from living in those states. And when they became somebody else, they began to signal new genes in new ways. And as they began to change their mind and body, they literally became somebody else, and they got pretty healthy.
Is that what you mean by spontaneous remissions?
Yeah, when, you know, my original work that I did was about 10 years ago, where I traveled around the world and interviewed people that were diagnosed with conditions like cancer and diabetes, et cetera, MS. And they were treating both conventionally and non-conventionally, and they were either staying the same or getting worse, and then all of a sudden they got better. And I wanted to see what the cause was that produced that effect. So when I interviewed them, I found out that there were some things that they had in common that I wanted to see if we would be able to reproduce. In other words, if we could hone in on the qualities that they did inside of them that produced that result, and then teach people how to do the same, would it produce a similar result? And so that's what got me, first of all, studying the science behind it. And once I understood the science behind it, of course, science is reproducible. So then I said, let's see if we can reproduce it. And when we follow that model of unlearning and relearning, you know, reminding yourself who you no longer want to be, and then reminding yourself who you do want to be, and use meditation as the means to change the brain and body, we were able to see some pretty amazing spontaneous remission. Yes.
Do people get emotional doing this? Do they break down? Do they cry?
A lot of times, you know, energy is stored in the body, and when it's stored in the body, it has to be released. And for some people, the release is emotional. Other people, it's just the opposite. It's absolutely freeing. That when they're freed from those emotional states that keep them in such pain or in such torture, there's a liberation of energy. And so it could come across as laughing, it could come across as crying, it could come across as a big emotional release in terms of a sound. We've seen all kinds of things, but really it's when the body's liberated, and when the body has that moment of liberation, it doesn't want to live in that state any longer. It wants to be free, and so we've seen all kinds of what we call abreactions or emotional reactions that take place, but it's not necessary.
Our guest, Dr. Joe Dispenza, we're talking about his work, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself, How to Simply Lose Your Mind and Create a New One. Male, female, does it work for both?
Oh, absolutely. We've seen it work across the board, young, old. You know, people always say, God, I'm too old to change, and I always say, really? Have you seen the latest research on stroke victims that if you have a stroke and you give the person the right knowledge and the right instruction and they stay diligent with it, that the brain can literally rewire itself around the lesion and people can regain mobility back. And that's been done many times and reproduced many times. So, and these people were in their 70s, and some of them had strokes, had paralysis for years. So the brain is that neuroplastic. If you give it the right learning, you give it the right information, and then the right instruction and the right feedback, the brain can literally rewire itself.
Well, it probably can. Are there any downsides to any of this, Joe?
Well, I haven't seen any downsides to it. The only thing, at times, people get a little bit nervous if they've had early abuse as a child, or they've had some difficult traumas. Sometimes some strong emotions come up, and we ask them to go slow and steady. But for the most part, the results that we've seen, George, have been really positive, and people not only change their health, but they change their life.
Super. Joe, we're going to come back, final hour, phone calls and stories. If you've changed your life, share it. Questions with Dr. Joe Dispenza next.